welcome. This is the first time that, we've kind of held a discussion like this, so kind of bear with us a little bit, I guess. I'm from a company called Non-Zero-One. There's six of us in the company. We're photographers, dancers, performers, and we formed in 2009 and at university, and we make kind of interactive work, and we've been making work for audiences of between 1 and 12 for sort of the past couple of years. And we kind of met the same sort of challenges that we came to with each piece. And with that, we decided, with working as a core artist at Forest Fringe this year, we were really lucky to have Jewood Foundation curatorial money, and we decided what we'd like to do is be very nosy and kind of find out how other people working in the same area were making interactive work, whether they were finding the same challenges as us, and kind of where they felt that kind of work was heading. A lot of people talk about interactive work as being the future of theatre, a lot of people talk about interactive work being a zeitgeist, but I think today is kind of just looking at what the process is and what it means for the audience or participants and what their work is all about. So I'll just give a quick introduction to all the people on the panel. Next to me here, I have Mark Daniels, who's the Artistic Director of In Space, which is part of New Media Scotland. You're not.
I'm Executive Director of New Media Scotland, and I'm the Creative Director of In Space.
There we go. Titles are a lot more impressive
than
what I
Very, very sensitive-ish.
Very, very sensitive. But now we've cleared that up.
That's okay.
And In Space is a lab to explore the cultural significance of infographics. Do shout if it's kind of wrong, because clearly...
Should I bite my lip?
No. I think it's better that
it's interactive.
We actually know. Yes. Rather than just some waffle that I've found. But working a lot with interactive art and visuals.
Yes.
Okay, got one thing right. Okay, that's good. And then we have Haran here, who's a co-artistic director of Fierce with Laura McDermott, and is also producing London and Satel's piece, Rotating in a Room of Images, which is being performed next week at Summer Hall from the 22nd to the 27th. Haran was previously a producer at BAC and the Royal Opera House, and collaborates with Helen Walker, as they are here. Lynn Gardner at the end, not the end, in the middle. Lynn is a founder member of City Limits, which is a large publishing cooperative in Europe, and writes about theatre and performance for The Guardian, and has also brought out a new children's book called Olivia's First Term, which is published by
Nosy Crow.
And then we have Alex Fleetwood of Hide and Seek. Everyone's looking so scared because I could literally be making up anything right now.
I was trying to smile.
The smile of fear. Alex founded Hide and Seek in 2007. Hide and Seek have done a range of things, including setting up Weekenders at South Bank, which they're now artists in residence. And also they've made Tate Trumps, which won a Guardian New Media Award. Alex also sits on the advisory panel for Artists Taking the Lead, and won the incredibly long title, let's see if I can get this right, British Council UK Young Performing Arts Entrepreneur of the Year Award.
Or BCUCPA for short.
BCUCPA. Fancy. And Hide and Seek are doing Hinterland here at Forest Fringe next door in the Action Room, and it's a collaboration with the poet Ross Sutherland, and that's every day from 12 till 6, and if you've not done it, go check it out, because it's great. And then we have Matt Adams here, who's the co-founder and artist with Blast Theory, who was set up in 1991, and they make pervasive games, interactive theatre, online and gallery work, and have had no less than 4 BAFTA nominations. Is that right?
But never won.
Not that we're bitter about that, and did win the Pre-Arts Electronica Award, so that's good. And they're showing Machine to See With, which is on from the 24th to the 28th, over at St. George's West. And finally, I have my good friend and colleague, John Hunter, who's going to be speaking up for Non-Zero-One, and also works as an artist assistant for Blast Theory, so there's kind of a Blast Theory crew posse over there. So that's a brief introduction to everyone. Kind of the reason we wanted to do this as an introduction is that designing an experience that reacts to the input of its participants comes with its own set of challenges. Surely effective, interactive and participatory work from theatre to gaming to the undefined, it must aim for meaningful interaction and to listen and respond to the choices of the actions of the participants. And so we wanted to look at how do theatre makers, promoters, critics and participants approach work that's designed to be different with every showing. And one thing that we could start with is Alex very well wrote a blog yesterday for part of Hide and Seek, which responded actually to the title of this discussion called Interactivity in the Age of the Audience. And it was talking about how audiences require performance, performers, stages, places and backstages, kind of looking at that role of the audience in an institution. And maybe the age of the audience actually isn't quite the right title for this discussion. So I just wanted to open that up, probably to Alex first.
In my big mouth.
Yeah, no, so kind of what did you think about that?
Well, I think, so we're, I mean, I'm a game designer coming out, I think we're all looking in at this brave new world of practice and possibility and opportunity. But we're all kind of looking at it from the places where we started, so we're kind of entering into it from different territories. And I have no history as a theatre maker. I have collaborated now with theatre makers, but it's not in my bones, it's not in my DNA or my kind of upbringing. And so I think when I look at the kind of, exactly as you were saying, like how do you offer people choices which have a meaningful outcome? And you know, you can call it interactivity, you can call it play, you can call it agency. That kind of nucleus of that challenge sometimes gets conflated with responding to that challenge within theatres. And theatres are amazing pieces of technology. Extraordinary amount of infrastructure. You know, lots of different things that kind of combine. But they combine in a way which is primarily about performance and audience. And an audience, I think what I was trying to get at with is that an audience implies performers, that you know you've got to be watching something, you've got to be kind of consuming something as a spectacle. And sometimes I think there's a tension in those two things, that kind of true agency and kind of open-endedness doesn't necessarily confine itself particularly well within the kind of boundaries and infrastructures of theatres. And I think that sometimes you kind of hit up against those problems, and you're trying to reconcile something which still needs to kind of be like a show, which has a beginning and middle and an end, and a story and a narrative and a nice outcome and a thing that is kind of ordered and organised, with the agency of individuals, which is unpredictable and messy and fluid and divergent. And there's a kind of tension between the organisation and infrastructure and dramaturgy of theatre and whatever it is that we need to invent to support participation and interaction. And that was just what that kind of reflected for me out of that title. And I mean, I think it, I'm sorry, that was mean of me to start by undermining the title of the thing, but that was what I felt in response to it, I guess.
Brilliant. And Matt, do you kind of feel that with Blast Theory, do you view your participants, or do you view them as an audience? Do you feel that you're making shows?
It is always very fluid, and I would normally use the word participant. And I totally agree with you, Alex, that it's so defined by where people come from, because I spend a lot of my time with people who refer to people as users all the time, and are quite happily using the term user-generated content, which is three of the sort of ugliest words I think of for people who are out in the public who actually create and contribute things towards a shared platform. You know, the idea that that's user-generated is pretty kind of toxic. So, but it comes from very particular disciplines, and so a lot of those people come out of computer science or human computer interaction or those kinds of areas where they're using, they employ the word user with a very precise focus. And we did go through a phase, a slightly pretentious phase, of sort of listing people as spectators and witnesses and observers and bystanders and all of that sort of stuff, trying to kind of really open out an umbrella to reflect the fact that people come at works in different ways. And you know, a lot of, or well, some of the work that's being made now actually has different audiences. You know, people see it at different points or in different ways or access it in different ways. And I think that that then really dramatically changes what each of those audiences bring to it and take from it and understand by it. So there is a kind of fragmentation there and a loosening, you know, and I think that that's a very important thing, because the one of the starting points from the work that we made was the sense that if theatre is to survive against electronic media, at least it should be live. You know, at least you should sit in a West End theatre and not think this is day 784 for these people and tomorrow will be day 785, you know. So, you know, the work that we, you know, our original kind of sort of skewing off from conventional sort of theatrical practice was based around the sense of like, well, whatever happens, we want people to come and see something where the liveness is an integral part, and there's a sense of flexibility and unpredictability about how that liveness unfolds.
No, it's interesting because actually the one of the comments on Alex's blog from someone called Bob Peters was that the value of theatre is in its immediacy, not in its scale. And in that sense, I kind of wanted to ask, like, maybe Harren, like, what do you feel in terms of, like, interactive theatre? Does it always need to be small scale? I mean, come to Alex as well. Like, do you feel that you can be personal to an audience that's larger than a kind of few people scenario?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I would take a step back and just look at the word interactive and interactivity before we begin, because I guess there are many levels of interactivity, and that can range from what you might call more open systems, perhaps something like Hinterland, where there's a lot of choice as to what you as an audience member might do, and then a work like Rotating in a Room of Images, in which you're given a wireless audio guide and you're on a track, if you like, and that entire piece of work can very easily derail if you step off of that track. And that then begins to open up for me questions around what do we mean by interactivity and how much is it about the audience's capacity to change the course of what's happening, or is it at the level of how you're feeling at a given moment? And I think once you start to think about the range of what interactivity can mean, perhaps we move away from the danger of kind of distinguishing the interactivity of theatre now and maybe how it was in the Elizabethan age, where you still would have had an aspect of interactivity, be that heckling or throwing your rotten tomatoes, and performers would be pausing and responding or amping something up. So again, going back to interactivity and this notion of the age of the audience, are we talking about how digital culture in particular is changing that relationship? And then with audience, I think it's very much up to us and the media and producers, curators, and artists to kind of make the language their own, in a sense, because if you continue to use the word audience for a blast theory piece, that then just simply shifts what we come to mean collectively by audience. And it isn't necessarily about adopting terminology from other disciplines. I guess you can expand what a word means and the fluidity with which it's received.
And Mark, I mean, a lot of the people here, we consider ourselves as kind of theatre makers. Is that the case in New Media Scotland, or is it slightly different with the visual arts approach?
I mean, from a visual arts approach, I think I would look at, from one perspective, we have a situation where our performers are machines. So those machines are interacted with before the audience come to the event. That affects that machine's performance during the event. And they continue that interaction once they go home. So, for example, Cyberphon, which is currently over at InSpace right now, which is an autonomous emotional robot band. And it googles itself every 15 seconds to see how popular it is, and that affects its playing style. It's a diva, and essentially, you know, on its birthday, it gets very, very happy. A state of delirium, has an emotion meter in the middle. There's also great merchandise attached to that as well. I am feeling, etc. But next day, it's really difficult to please. So the performance for the next day for those people is very hard, because essentially it goes into the pits of depression. So the actual audience have got to work a lot harder to get a better performance out of the machine. Mm-hmm. So by tweeting about it, by poking it on Facebook. And then, you know, we know that it takes, you know, 5 pokes on Facebook, it'll go one step up happier. It's like the capometer, but in reverse. Because the performer can't perform unless it knows it has attention from the audience. But on the flip side of that, when we're doing something like expanded cinema over in space, that's a situation where we will hand an artist over the ability to do an experiment during the show. So the interaction is actually something very, very, very artisan approach, and which means that we almost can never replicate it. So if we did do the same show twice, which we almost never do, it would be quite difficult, because the nuances of the performance of the performer are what's making it quite special, but that's always about interaction with the audience that's live. Mm. So at one end, we've got really great examples of artificial intelligence affecting the kind of the theatre. Mm. And then at the other end, it's actually about examples of new media practice which don't involve computers and don't involve microchips and don't involve batteries. It's other forms of new media practice which enable a different level of interaction with the audience that you can't replicate. So it's not the situation of where, okay, I can't be prepared here, I don't know how much I'm going to mix of this particular solution. The screening of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, where we created a signature scent during the screening itself, and that was like, you know, that was like playing chemistry sets. It could never, you couldn't do it at the same time, and half of the, some of the scents were distributed amongst the audience for them to deploy themselves. So it's all about, well, who's, you know, who's up for this? Who's up for blowing bubbles at that moment in the film? So, you know, that's what makes it different, and again, it's always about that dynamic. I've got about 2,500 regular guinea pigs for experiments across there, and once they realise they can get involved in something, they're kind of, they're up for it, but they know that we hardly ever do the same thing twice. So from my perspective, it's just interesting to hear, particularly when you have things that are repeated and have to be repeated because of the nature of either the way it's funded, the way it's just orchestrated. I don't know if we're ever going to go down that route where we repeat stuff. But when we do repeat stuff, it's a situation where we're letting the machines themselves monitor the audience and then changing the nature of the performance.
Mm. It's really, it's a really interesting, like, I know that with Non-Zero One, we kind of refer to this sort of audience response area as kind of blank space. And John, maybe you could talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, well, certainly just going from what something Alex was saying earlier about the challenge of coming up with the structure to support interactivity, and that comes up with sort of something that has to be repeated. I mean, we're doing the show 12 times up here at Forest Fringe, and when we first did a scratch of the Time Out, we knew that it had to be a 20-minute scratch, and so we wrote 20 minutes of script, and we tried it out on a test audience, and it was just terrible. It was so boring, because we just talked for 20 minutes to the people who were supposedly our participants, and we realised that all we'd done was make a show where they couldn't actually see us, but effectively they were just there, sat down, and we weren't asking a single question of them. And I think we really did that out of anxiety, that we knew that it was our job to create a show, and that we knew that if it had to be 20 minutes and we wrote 20 minutes, it would be 20 minutes, and we know it would run the same way every time, and that would be done and dusted and fine. But of course that was sort of running counter to our aims in a way, because what we were really hoping to create was something that had to be a conversation, and had to be something that took input from our participants and fed it back into then what would happen during the show. And so although it would be repeated every night, it would be different every night, because it needs to completely reflect the participants who are taking part. And so what we found is that in order to do 20 minutes of the show, we really needed to be writing 10 minutes of script and asking 10 minutes of questions, or allowing 10 minutes for play, or allowing 10 minutes for people to talk. And it was like working with a completely bonkers new structure for us, because the script that we've got now doesn't look anything like a script. It looks like a few words followed by like pages of, if this happens, do this, and if this happens, do this, and if this happens, then, I've got no idea what happens next. And there are sort of various boxes, and we have a sort of system whereby there are two narrators, and we have a sheet where you sort of get to a point in the script, and it's just like, whatever the person says here when you ask them this question, write it down in box 8-9. And so the other person is like writing, they love their wife because she's really beautiful, or something like that. And then when you get to later in the piece, when you're thinking, it would be really nice to refer to this in some way because this is something that people have offered up, you've got a certain bank of knowledge and input that you can then refer back to. And I think that also going from something Matt said about liveness is that it's not to confuse liveness with interactivity, because obviously if you're doing an end-on show and you've got an audience sat there, you are responding to them. You're responding to if they're laughing, you're responding to if it's going really badly, you're pausing at moments when you think that they're going to love it. And it's just about to what extent you build into your structure what you're willing to do about that, and how much you want your piece to become a cycle that takes that back in and throws it back out, and to also make that in a way that you're not just showing that you've done it, but to make it actually worthwhile for the people. Because I mean, it could get really formulaic that somebody says something and you just go, well, as you said earlier, because we wrote this down, by the way, because we're very clever, you would do this, that and the other, and it's like, yes, well done, you've recorded what I said, and then just said it later. And it's just like, how do you make interaction sort of value to the people who are taking part, and what can they sort of stand to how can it enrich their experience while they're right there and you've got them? So.
Yeah. Do you feel free to butt in if anything?
I have a really interesting question. It may be a very boring question, but what I'm interested in is, but when you're doing Time Out, do audiences actually really behave like traditional audiences to a large extent? I.e., do they actually sort of follow the script that you have laid down, even though you've allowed room for them to react in different ways? Because it seems to me that one of the things that, you know, happens to us as audiences, if we're going to use that word, is that you know, we know the conventions. And I think that often with interactivity, one of the things that happens as a member of an audience is that you feel quite scared as a member of an audience. At least you know if you're going to see Look Back in Anger that you go and sit down in a seat, and that everything is going to happen behind a fourth wall in front of you. Whereas as a member of an audience, you know, of a show that's interactive, you actually, to a large extent, feel, at least I do, and I've seen lots of them, I go in and I feel really nervous. And I think, when I get in there, and will I have to turn over a sign on the door and it says, take your clothes off? And if it does, do I actually do that? And so I suppose what I'm interested in is, how does the audience actually behave? Because my suspicion is that actually, on the whole, we do still behave a bit like sheep.
Yeah, well, I mean, you owe your audience, your participants, a huge debt, and you can't forget that. If you're making a piece of work like we are, where effectively you're saying, yes, you've got some freedom, and this bit's, you know, up to you what happens here, but there are certain bits where really we do just need you to go along with it, because if you don't, it's all just going to go to shit. And that contract, I think, is a big responsibility for the people making the work and structuring the work, in that if you're going to ask people to effectively perform your show for you and make your show for you, they can't just be doing it because they know that that contract is there, and that if they don't, it's going to all fall apart. There needs to be an incentive, a sort of, I don't know, not dramatic incentive, but there needs to be a reason within the piece why they'd want to do that, other than just, I'm doing this for you because I know that if I don't, it's all going to go wrong. And I think that that's a responsibility there, to make it worth people's while, to be able to give them a reason to know why they would want to do that, other than just because you say so. And
I think one idea of interactivity that's come out is that, I was having a discussion last night, that there's a vulnerability on both parts. So in order for it to work well, there needs to be a certain vulnerability that the audience or participants lend into, that also the artist is willing to give up as well. There's certainly areas in our script where anything could be said, anything could be done, that we kind of have to respond to, and we're still doing it in a way that we kind of feel comfortable with. But I know that a lot of other performers like really take that to extremes, and I wonder kind of how do you guys work with that as well? Like, do you ever feel that you've kind of given over too much vulnerability to the as an artist and letting the audience take over too much? Do you ever feel that that ever happens?
I think it's, as well as people being sheep, which I think is absolutely true, I think there's also a kind of courtesy thing, which is that people sort of feel that they want this thing to succeed, they're not sure what the rules are, and they're looking very much to support it. There's a lot of goodwill around, a lot of nice middle class people coming to these shows, and that's so very much
self, a self-selecting band extra enthusiastic middle class people.
Yeah, and then what you get actually is a tremendously compliant set of exchanges, and you know, we've actually made a piece of work specifically to kind of look at that, inviting you to pretend to be a terrorist, who were two of the most non-compliant people you could ever imagine. Precisely because we suddenly had this kind of slightly creepy feeling of having been to a few interactive shows and thinking, actually, you are a rat running through a series of gates. You are not interacting, and that and as you do that, you're sort of losing some of your ability to interact in some of the richer ways that you might with linear media. And you know, this is where we can, you know, where we can try to not repeat some of the sort of pitfalls that people have had in the tech environment, because in the late 90s, the idea that sort of interaction was about empowerment and democracy and things like that was really current among people who were net enthusiasts, and gradually that's been sort of tempered and stripped away as people have realised that it's nothing of the kind. You know, it's not, they're not equivalent, and I think, you know, that's at least a useful thing for those of us who are involved in this work to kind of have a sense of modesty about just how jazzy our formal innovation is in terms of what it really offers. It does offer some tremendously powerful and exciting things, but not lots of the things that you might immediately associate with it are not so true, I think.